This was obvious by how much the conversation bounced around to every topic like a pinball game, but always ended up with me talking about it. To be honest, it was making me manic. One minute we'd be laughing fools, the next I'd be taking deep breaths and pushing down the emotions. By the time we got to the sixth or seventh cafe and the subsequent number of glasses of wine, I couldn't keep it down anymore. The emotions boiled over. I love him. I love him so much, and it kills me to know how much he's hurting right now, I said while stuffing potatoes in my face. Jarrett listened with an empathetic, mm-hmm, here or there. It's like this, I continued, grabbing the tablecloth underneath our bounty of carbs and booze. It's like, here was our life, and I just ripped it out from under him. I considered attempting the ripping the tablecloth out trick, but luckily resisted. The couple beside us looked like they could get engaged at any moment, and they didn't need it ruined by some insane red-headed lady with a purple wine mouth attempting to do a magic trick. I pulled myself back together, taking a deep breath. Enough of this cute shit. Let's settle up and go find a dive bar, I said, tossing the end of a baguette in my purse. I was back to skipping down the street with Jarrett. We ended up finding a rowdy little bar tucked into a side street. Truth be told, in that part of Paris, there weren't any dive bars per se, but this place was a perfect mix of grungy and quaint. We started talking to the locals, and by that I mean I started flirting with old men. This is my favorite sport. Not in a, this old man thinks he's gonna get laid kind of way. That's not my end game. Just a little harmless banter to remind them of some firecracker of a lady they knew back in their youth who was too much for them to handle and who they've always regretted letting go. I consider it my way of giving back. It got rowdy. And by that, I mean we were doing shots of gin. Who does shots of gin? At one point, after being my sassy self, a man of at least 75 said to me, "You scare me. I've never been scared of a woman before. I like it." Many, many drinks later, Jarrett and I poured onto the street, the last ones to leave the bar. It was perfect out. The streets were empty, save for a few other drunkards here or there getting late-night street food. We had no idea how to get back to our place since we just wandered around all day without paying attention. After about an hour of looking, we finally found the apartment. "This is so goddamn French," Jarrett said as we were once again squished into the tiniest elevator known to man. "It's also a lot less scary when you've had 4 gallons of alcohol." To our surprise, Tony was still awake. For a man who doesn't drink, he can stay up with the best of them. He started talking to us, in a slight accent, about all the places he had explored that day. He even bought us little light-up Eiffel Tower keychains because he's thoughtful like that. He was halfway through telling us about an art exhibit that had really knocked his socks off when I went to go check my phone. I'd left it in the apartment to really take a day to soak in Paris and not be constantly trying to figure out how to ask for the Wi-Fi password at each new stop. I picked it up and saw I had a message in WhatsApp. I opened it up, and it was simply a pic of beans from my ex. And that, dear listeners, is when I lost it. All the emotions and guilt and sadness mixed together like the ingredients for a science fair volcano, and I erupted. Besides reacting to an actual death, I was bawling harder than I ever have before. It's the kind of crying where you can't catch your breath, the type where you're howling, hyperventilating, wiping snot from your face on repeat. "Are you okay?" Jarrett and Tony stood in the doorway, looking concerned. I motioned them in and tried to get my breathing under control, but it was no use. I started wailing. Rather than tuck me in and go to sleep with earplugs in, you know what those two dudes did? They listened as I dove into what I was feeling. I don't have anyone waiting for a goodnight text anymore, or to go back and forth about what I want for dinner, I ugly cried, and I'm okay with that, but what if he's not? How the hell is he going to figure out what he wants for dinner? I was a blubbering mess, barely making any sense, but that didn't matter to Jarrett and Tony. They weren't going anywhere. Jarrett rubbed my back as Tony rubbed my feet. This was not how I pictured being touched by a man in Paris. But it was just what I needed. We stayed up all night, eventually falling asleep, as the sun peeked through the Juliet balconies of our flat. The next morning, I woke up dehydrated and a little embarrassed. But that went away quickly. Not the dehydration, that was staying. Mama needed some Pedialyte up in this pied-à-terre. But the embarrassment dissolved as soon as I met the guys in the living room, sprawled out on that gaudy gold couch. I was greeted with smiles and hugs, and God damn it, I was so lucky to have been there in that moment with these two. I thought about what an incredibly important trip it had been, In fact, that rom-com poster that I loved so much and thought had made zero sense was almost a prediction for this entire trip. Sometimes love is sweet like a salty rose. In our case, it was definitely salty like fries and rosé. Sometimes it's sweet like candies. Lucky for me, I had these two sweeties with me to lean on. And sometimes it's so spicy that it makes your eyes watery. Seeing as that was the hardest I've ever cried, them eyes were watery all right. This was not how I pictured my Paris trip. Crying on two guys instead of falling in love with some hunky French dude? Based on my emotional breakdown, I was clearly not even ready to have kissed someone on that trip. But that was okay. Months later, Serena came over to film a video for my YouTube channel, and I told her how I had finally ripped off the Band-Aid and gotten some action. It was time! I hadn't kissed anyone since my ex, I said as I set up the tripod. Amory, what the hell are you talking about? I looked up at her confused. Do you not remember that night at the bar where you flipped off the DJ? I looked at her concerned as she continued. I literally had to pull you off some local. You were making out with him in front of everyone. I burst out laughing. Why didn't you bring that up the next day? You'd had a rough night. You deserved to have some random makeout in can. So Jarrett and I decided that our MIPS were sealed. Her eyes went wider than turtle eggs. I did it! I finally did it, she exclaimed with such innocent pride. You would have thought she was a 5-year-old who just hit a home run in T-ball. It only took a few months, but she'd actually nailed a pun. I was proud of Serena, but even prouder of myself. There I was, thinking that I hadn't reached the goal I'd set for myself in France, but I had crushed it all along. Was it with a hot, mysterious businessman? Or some toothless degenerate who didn't speak a lick of English? Maybe it was a DJ. Some men are turned on by an extremely rude woman who flips them the bird. We may never know. All I needed to know was that I'd done it. I had officially kissed someone else and didn't have to worry about if it was good or not, or if I was out of practice because I couldn't remember a damn thing. I had ripped off the Band-Aid, or dare I say, the Band-Aid had been mipped off. Take a look at this picture of us in Paris. That's Jared on the left, Tony in the middle, and me. Yep, I was in Paris with these two beautiful men, and all I did was cry. Go me. Moulin Rouge. You know how when you're binge-watching a show on Netflix, you hit next episode immediately as soon as it gets to the credit sequence? I did this when I was watching Breaking Bad to the point where I found myself in the same sweatpants and no shower for days, feeling like I was the one doing meth. Well, consider this chapter one where you just hit next episode, because as soon as that night in Paris ended, I was on another adventure. The day after my meltdown, I decided to get some fresh air and give those boys a break from my estrogen parade. Everything was prettier in daylight. Cobblestone streets lined with tables of beautiful produce, storefront after storefront of bouquets and baked goods. At any point, I expected an animated Belle to swing out of a store, running her trap about the latest book she read. But instead, I was stopped in my tracks by another sight. My friend Sarah, looking down at her phone and talking to herself, trying to figure out directions. Sarah? She looked up. It was so nice to see her familiar eyes and shocked face. What the fuck, she said, almost dropping her phone. I can't believe, out of a city of 2.5 million people, I run into someone I know on day 2? And not just someone, but you! What are you doing here? It's Lorraine's birthday, she exclaimed. I had met Lorraine back on a trip to Costa Rica for Sarah's 40th. Okay, before I go any further, allow me to give you a little backstory on these friendships so you can see just how kismet and perfect it was to run into Sarah on this trip. Sarah was the drummer in a band I was in for 7 years back when I lived in Brooklyn. We were called Kudzu and the Faggots, and we were your not-so-typical party band. We wore matching outfits and performed choreography and did antics on stage like burst balloons full of glitter as we screamed, "Pussy farts!" This level of classy spectacle also made its way over to our song names, such as "Oops, I Fucked Your Brothers," "14 Carat Fetus," "Machine Gun My Poon," "Daddy Issues." We even had a song called "French Braid," about moving to France because no one in America appreciated the classic hairdo, and wearing it in France somehow made you irresistible. We would count in the song by counting down in French, except, since it was kudzu, instead of un, deux, trois, quatre, it was un, deux, trois, quatre. You can see a picture of the cover of our second album called Daddy Issues. And fun fact, that was actually the stoop from the apartment I lived in Brooklyn for 7 years. Clearly, we were never asked to play at a wedding. Anyway, Sarah was our little animal from the Muppets, rocking out behind the drum kit. But not only that, she's a goddamn neuropsychologist who also looks like Laura Flynn Boyle circa Twin Peaks. Jess is here too, Sarah said. I almost slapped myself across the face. Jess is here? Jess was another bandmate and one of my best friends. Nowadays, she's a makeup artist and hair guru who owns her own eyebrow bar in Louisville, Kentucky. Honestly, the woman can somehow take pencil-thin frown emoji brows and shape them into baby Brooke Shield brows. I was bugging out that this was happening. Wait, who else is here? You, Jess? I was still in shock. Well, it's me, Lorraine, Jess, and then a couple more girls you met on the Costa Rica trip. This was amazing. Sarah and Jess are like family to me, and while I'd only hung out with the Costa Rica crew once before, it was one of those trips that, within the first few hours of meeting one another, we were running around the jungle, naked and wasted, and chopping open coconuts with machetes to fill with rum. These girls were hell on wheeling suitcases, and a wild night out with them was exactly what I needed after the previous night's cry fest. I have to hang out with you girls tonight. Do you have anything planned? I just knew with these ladies' track record that they were going to be up to something good, or ideally, no good. Cut to 4 hours later, and I'm sitting in a tiny 200-year-old church listening to a cello concert. Yeah, that's right. Seven women sitting in silence as a Swedish man performed a solo cello concert to five sparsely filled wooden pews. It was beautiful. It was surreal. And I was surreally tired because a few glasses of Cote d'Iron and slow classical music do not mix. I looked to my right and saw Sarah doing the old falling asleep, then as soon as your head is down, you pop it back up routine. Bitch was doing it to the beat. I nudged Jess, who immediately pursed her lips to try to seal off a laugh. That's when what I call the Mamrie Mumbles start up. The Mamrie Mumbles are a classic move that happens when I want to laugh in a socially inappropriate setting, so I just laugh without opening my mouth. My lips may be closed, but you can still hear the laughing inside my mouth chamber, like how you walk past a club and you hear the faint pulse of a driving bass. The other thing I do when I either laugh really hard or I'm trying really hard not to laugh is physically hurt others. I'm a big grab someone's wrist as hard as I can while I throw my head back laughing kind of gal. And if I'm trying not to laugh, you're going to want to get as far away from me as possible. I will end up gripping your thigh or pinching your elbow. Whatever it takes to try to put my energy away from laughing and into something else. There I was, trying not to piss my pants laughing in this beautiful, quiet, historic church. Not much had changed since the days of being a little girl, sitting in the pews of Boonville Methodist back in the day. I'd see an old lady start to bob her head to sleep during the sermon, or a dad a few rows up, coyly trying to pick a wedgie when the congregation stood for a hymnal, and I would turn into a 4'2" giggle fest. My mom would give me death stares from the choir, and now I was getting those same old lady death stares from a cotton-headed senior a row over. I gripped Jess's elbow, and after what seemed like a lifetime of mumbles and 84 concertos later, homeboy stood up to bow. That was incredible, Sarah said, passing the pad CU around the table of a teensy Thai restaurant across from the church. It was gorgeous, Jess agreed. It was, I chimed in, mouthful of popping hot spring rolls. I held up a finger to denote that these things were cabbage lava and did one of those chews where you're simultaneously blowing on the food as you eat it. You know, the kind of wide mouth chomps that make you look like a dog actor that's been fed peanut butter so a C-list actor can dub their voice to their flapping dog gums. I swallowed and continued. But let's be real. I started counting how many times Sarah checked her program. Final tally, 38. And Jess, you straight up slept through a whole song. I wanted to Snapchat it, but I was scared it would play back with volume. We all laughed and admitted how bored we were. I mean, we were talking about a group of women in which three of them used to be in a band that would force audience members to bong a beer out of a giant penis if it was their birthday. They nodded in agreement. Look, I know y'all have been doing a ton of cultural stuff, and that is super cool, but how'd you feel about me planning what we do tomorrow night? Lorraine, do you care if I take over your birthday trip that I wasn't invited to? Lorraine nodded her head. I'd love nothing more. Ugh! I know exactly what we are going to do, I said, a grin cracking across my face. because I knew that the next day, so help me God, we were going to do something that had been a dream of mine since I was knee-high to a grasshopper. We were going to go to Moulin Rouge. That's right. Since I was a wee thing, going to the world-famous home of the Can-Can had been on my bucket list. My obsession with burlesque started when I was 10 years old, when my stepmom, Anne, showed me the movie Gypsy. Gypsy is about a girl who grew up to be the most famous burlesque dancer in the world, Gypsy Rose Lee. Hell, I was so obsessed with it that my junior year of high school, I convinced my theater teacher to do it as a spring musical. I, of course, had to play the namesake. It was a great show. We built adorable sets and taught the country boys in our school, who would finally come out of the closet years later, how to tap dance. We even got a real baby lamb from a local farm that my character is given for her birthday. Perfect and adorable, right? Well, it was, until I got to the part of the play on opening night where I had to pull down the straps of my red sequin dress to appear topless while doing a breathy version of Let Me Entertain You and accidentally made eye contact with my 83-year-old papa in the process. More than a little awkward. My love for Gypsy bit me in the ass later in life, too. There was a magical 6-month period when Anne and I were both living in New York City. She was still in the TV producing business. Now she's a reverend. Talk about a job change. And the show she was working on filmed out of the city. It was a great bonding time between the two of us. We would get nice dinners and have sleepovers, and every couple of weeks, my dad would fly up to spend time with us. It was a blast. One particular weekend was like any other in Anne's Big Apple residency. I joined her and my dad for an early dinner and said my goodbyes outside afterward. They were headed to her Upper East Side rental, and my ass was going down to the Lower East Side to meet my friends and boyfriend for a burlesque show at the Slipper Room. "Burlesque!" Anne exclaimed, clearly feeling those Chardonnays. "David, we have to go." I panicked. What? I hadn't had a guy meet my parents since high school. I couldn't let them tag along and have this first meeting take place in a grungy bar. But before I could object, Anne whistled for a cab, which I didn't even know she could do, and I found myself sliding over to make room for my folks in the back seat. I immediately texted my boyfriend to give him a heads up. It read, "Warning! I am running, like, 10 minutes late. Also, my parents are with me. Also, for the next few hours, you aren't a smoker." Once we got there, they all said their hellos, while Anne tried to not look like a drug dog sniffing out the tobacco on my new boyf. And then we took our seats. It took about 10 seconds of the performance to realize that this was not the type of burlesque Anne was expecting. Let me try to conjure up this visual for you. The woman on stage had her left arm hanging like normal, and a fake right arm made to look like it was tied to her chest. Then, her real right arm, covered in black with her hand exposed at the end, looking all severed and cut at the wrist, appeared. For the next 3 minutes, which felt like a leap year's amount of time, she danced as if the detached hand was crawling all over her to the tune of "I Put a Spell on You." Boob grabbing and simulating diddling her skittle was also included. This was not "Let Me Entertain You." This was "Let Me Enter My Own Body." You know that feeling when you're watching a movie with your parents and a sex scene starts and it gets unbelievably painful? You don't know what real pain is. Anyway, back to classier times. You're probably familiar with Moulin Rouge from the 2001 Baz Luhrmann film in which Ewan McGregor's character, a poet, falls in love with a bombshell cabaret star played by Nicole Kidman. Nicole gives, in my opinion, one of the greatest foreshadowed "I'm about to die" coughs in modern cinema, second only to Claire Danes in Little Women, who straight killed it. The movie is hyper-vibrant and flashy, as if everything is coated in fairy dust and someone raised the saturation on it, Instagram edit style. As soon as I saw it, I wanted to crawl inside of it and live there. Once I scored the tickets for us, I could barely contain my excitement. I knew megastars Nicole and Ewan weren't going to be on stage or dancing through the sky, and the theater probably didn't have all the rights to the David Bowie songs that the movie soundtrack boasted, but I was going to the Moulin Rouge! I couldn't wait to taste the cold champagne that flowed so freely in the movie and sit back in my velvet banquette to be entertained by dolled-up women practically floating in heels and bejeweled high-cut thongs behind giant feather fans. I met the girls for a glass of champagne near the theater, excited to reveal my big plan. If you want to see what Jess and Sarah look like, there's a picture of us that very moment. "I've always wanted to go there," Sarah squealed, raising her glass for a cheers. "How did you get tickets so last minute?" "Eh, I pulled some strings. Specifically my purse strings. We have to pay for tickets. But, thanks to a little finagling, we get a couple bottles of bubbly for free. We all clicked our glasses in celebration. Ewan McGregor was so hot in Moulin Rouge, Jess said, with lust in her eyes that can only be brought on by having been married for a year. I had forgotten about old Ewan in the movie. Maybe there'd be a hot dude at the Moulin Rouge who I could fall in love with. My mind wandered, because I am a cartoon human with a constant running thought bubble. Mommy, Daddy, how did you meet? Well, darling, I was strolling through Moulin Rouge one crisp spring Parisian night when I walked past a table of obnoxious American women. As if in slow motion, the redhead laughed, throwing her head back and raising a toast to her friends. There I was, surrounded by dozens of some of the most beautiful women in the world, and it's like time stopped. Your mother was the only one I could see. We strutted into the Moulin Rouge feeling whimsical and ready to have the romance take hold. Everything was luxe. The red carpeting, the velvet curtains, the insane chandeliers. We sat at our adorable table with a portly Frenchman beside it, ready and willing to pour a champagne. After a cheers and some excited giggles, the lights went dim, and that's when I saw him. Nope, not my version of Ewan. I saw the gayest man alive. Y'all, I know that might not be the PC-est thing to say, but hot damn it was true. The man made Liberace look like a drill sergeant. Or for you younger listeners, he made Tyler Oakley look like Brock Lesnar of the WWE. This man was in head-to-toe sparkles in front of all the other dancers with their lavish headpieces. He was committed to every move with his whole being. However, he was also about one beat too fast for the rest of the group. It was painful, like when you watch someone giving their all in karaoke, but they're just a few words ahead or behind in the song than they should be. But unlike in karaoke, where the crowd can sing along and get their tone-deaf asses back on beat, we just had to watch this man and his off-time dancing from afar. We were witnessing the least sexy spectacle of our lives. Lavish? Yes. Garish? Yes. But sexy? Not in the least. Out of the sea of dancers and their rhinestones, a backup dancer emerged, lifting one of the sheer-suited females with ease. He looked like a tornado that had just plowed through a glitter factory. Finally, the song's pace slowed down, and the female dancer dismounted. The man found his spotlight and smiled proudly into the audience. "Doesn't that guy look like a fat Bill Hader?" Sarah whispered. I squinted my eyes past the sparkly mesh and, holy shit, he was the spitting image of Bill Hader from SNL. If Bill Hader had just been dumped and gained 40 pounds. This is the moment in the show where I never stop laughing. Just when he'd disappear into the wings and I could squelch my mamrie mumbles, he'd bust back out with such fervor that I'd lose it again. It didn't help that my friends kept saying things like, man, Stefan really let himself go. Maybe he got out of the club scene and this is rehab weight gain? Or, I wonder if Bill knows he was born a twin, but the other one was adopted in France. What's Bill in French? Still Bill? Really cool the studio let Bill out of his train wreck press tour to come live his true dream. Life's too short, you know? Moulin Rouge is not the place you're supposed to be belly laughing. It's supposed to be a sultry and swanky experience. Laughing at the show was as if your partner was dirty talking during sex and you returned the favor by guffawing in their face. I was squeezing Jess's thigh with a death grip. Luckily, the lights went dim, and Fat Hater exited the stage before I ripped her leg off and threw it on the table, a la Aviva popping off her prosthetic in season 6 of The Real Housewives of New York City. We all agreed that this felt like the Moulin Rouge B-Squad. It's like how people expect the Hollywood Walk of Fame to be glamorous, but when they get there, it's actually filled with dudes in knockoff Wolverine costumes charging $5 for a pic. This wasn't that big of a letdown, but it was definitely the dollar store version of what I'd imagined. And it was making me laugh so hard. I took some deep breaths and a few sips of champagne and tried to get back to normal. A few minutes later, the lights went dim again and the music started back up. The orchestral music was swirling as a spotlight shone at an opening at the far left corner of the stage, several feet off the ground. We waited eagerly, staring at the spotlight, waiting for something majestic to emerge, and then it finally did. Slowly but surely came Fat Bill Hader suspended by cables dressed as an astronaut. I lost my shit. Fuck the mumbles. Fuck trying not to injure my friends with my flailing arms and leg squeezes. I was losing my goddamn mind. Arms a-flailing. At one point, my hand hit something hard, and I looked back to see annoyed Gerard the waiter trying to open this beautiful French brute as this brute American was acting like she was at a Larry the Cable Guy show. Fat Bill Hader continued to walk in slow motion as the overworked cables slowly tracked him to the center of the room. There, he met his lady astronaut, who had come out from the opposite side of the stage as they lip-synced a love song together. This was no Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor falling in love while singing Heroes. And if this was space travel, Paris, we have a problem. After what felt like days, they finally pulled FBH backstage just as slowly as he had come out. And just like an astronaut returning to Earth, I could finally breathe again. The show continued to be a ridiculous parade of costumes and dance numbers, each outdoing the last in level of showmanship and not making a lick of damn sense. After it ended, we bundled up and walked back into the cold Parisian night. We all stood there in front of that neon windmill, flabbergasted at what we'd just seen. The Moulin Rouge couldn't have been more different than what I imagined it to be. It was better. While I loved the mystique surrounding the idea of it all, it was comforting to know that this fabled level of glamour wasn't really accurate. And as a redneck gypsy who once stripped in front of her grandpa and had a baby lamb piss in her lap on stage, I felt right at home. After a few minutes of recapping, we said our goodbyes. Kiss on each cheek, of course, because we were in France. It was such a quick visit, but that was okay because 3 weeks later, I was back in Europe with Jess for a trip we actually had planned to be on together. And oddly enough, we found ourselves at yet another sexy stage show, but this one was going to be a little different.
Amsterdam! Amsterdam for 20 Dixie Chicks. One of these things is not like the others. However, all three of these things added together equals the most epic girls' trip on the books. Or at least in this book. Let's start from the beginning. Okay, so I like cool music. I know I sound like someone who's rationalizing their taste after their friends find a Smash Mouth concert ticket in their purse, but you gotta trust me on this. You're talking to someone who decided to go to a George Clinton concert on her 21st birthday. I can do David Bowie's Aladdin Sane face paint on myself with my eyes closed. I have shaken Neil Young's hand and not fainted as he told me he loved my name. While most of my musical tastes fall in the rock and roll category, there's always been a special place in my heart for country music. Lady singers, especially. I'm talking Patsy Cline, Loretta Lynn, Tammy Wynette, and the Queen, Dolly Parton. As far as I'm concerned, once you have fleets of drag queens impersonating you, you've made it. I can only hope to be so lucky one day. These women are the classics, the standards. In the steakhouse of country music, they're the prime rib. But every so often, you just need some greasy drive-through, you know? In other words, sometimes you just need to crank some top 40 pop country and scream sing about a terrible ex-boyfriend and how you're drinking beer in a field somewhere. It's one of my unconventional methods of therapy. No disrespect to actual therapy, which is super useful and necessary for lots of people. Therapy is great, but this particular emotional release of singing slash screaming at the top of my lungs is something that's been working for me since high school. Your lover do you wrong? Crank up Winona Judd's No One Else on Earth. Leaving your home state to go follow your dreams on the other side of the country? Why, that's a perfect moment to dance to Jody Messina's Heads Carolina, Tails California. Get to California and feel like white trash in West Hollywood? Crank Gretchen Wilson's Redneck Woman to 11 and get pumped about where you came from. I connect with these songs. Unlike my bus size, my love of country music developed early in life. This is thanks in part to the fact that I grew up in Boonville, North Carolina. Imagine your quintessential small town in America. Now shrink that down to 10% and throw in a lot of cows. That's Boonville. To say I grew up in the sticks would be giving it too much credit. I grew up in the twigs, a place where lyrics about hooking up down by the river were relatable, seeing as the Fridays of my senior year were spent camping out on the banks of the Yadkin River with the quarterback and a quart of Mad Dog 2020. While the average person might scoff at a song about a woman slashing the tires of her cheating boyfriend's Dodge Ram, if you lived in Boonville, you not only related to this, you probably had a cousin on probation for that very charge. That's how country Boonville was. Pop country feels like home to me, like jazz does to New Orleans. My high school years were prime time for country pop music. You had your Martina McBrides, your Faith Hills, your Sarah Evanses. It was the golden age for stacked bob hairdos and flared light wash jeans. But of all the music that blasted through my shitty Honda Accord speakers during those high school years, the most frequently played had to be the Dixie Chicks. The Dixie Chicks are comprised of three gals, two of them sisters, who all sing like angels and play their instruments like devils. Specifically, a devil that went down to Georgia because one of them rocks a fiddle like a boss. Right out of the gate, you know that the Dixie Chicks are the shit because they have the word Dixie in their name. Dixie refers to the historical nickname for the South, but in my heart, it's in honor of Dixie Carter from Designing Women. Both Dixies, the group, and Julia Sugarbaker have more sass in their left titty on a typical Tuesday than most people carry in their whole body during a lifetime. When the Chicks burst onto the scene, or should I say hatched, with their breakthrough album Wide Open Spaces, I was in love. Who are these brassy blonde songbirds who can not only carry some sick three-part harmonies, but also play their own instruments? I can't tell you how many high school afternoons were spent cruising around the back roads of my little county with my friend Emily, windows down, singing our asses off to that album. I can close my eyes and be taken back to those moments. The humid country air whipping through our hair, the smell of honeysuckle in our noses, and the occasional Fast and Furious rolling up the windows because we were passing a chicken house and those reeked so fucking bad. Our love of singing that album was not confined only to my Accord or Emily's Plymouth either. Occasionally, when we were feeling ballsy, we'd sneak into the one bar within a 20-mile radius of my house to sing Wide Open Spaces at karaoke night. Yep, just your average bar filled with drunk rednecks and two 16-year-olds in head-to-toe Abercrombie & Fitch trying to break out some show choir harmonies. Two members of the Little Rascals standing on each other's shoulders in a long trench coat pretending to be one tall adult would have blended in better than we did. Wide Open Spaces and Fly weren't just catchy albums. They also had massive critical acclaim, too, racking up Grammys left and right. I thought nothing could stop the Dixie Chicks from soaring, until the Bush incident. The Chicks were performing at a concert in London right around the time when America was invading Iraq. Never one to shield her opinions, Natalie told the crowd, "Just so you know, we're ashamed the President of the United States is from Texas." Big whoop, right? I mean, as I write this, that misogynist cheeto of a man, Trump, is our president and says such blasphemous vitriol that I feel like I'm tripping every time I turn on the news. Meanwhile, Natalie says one comment and people start throwing their Fly CDs into a bonfire. Isn't that unbelievable? And not just because the visual of a bunch of burning CDs is so archaic. But just like that, the Chicks went into hibernation. Despite not having a new album in a decade, I'd still listen to all their classics on my fave Pandora station. One day, while Swiffering to There's Your Trouble blaring on my speakers, I went to go thumbs up the tune to show that algorithm who was boss. I looked down and there was a pesky little pop-up ad blocking the button. Now, normally, I would X out that pop-up ad like it was porn and I was sitting in a prayer circle. But this one stopped me. The Dixie Chicks were going on tour! I dropped the wet jet and ran to my laptop to Google it. Sure enough, there were dates. My teenage heart soared. But they were all in Europe. Splat. My heart dropped to my half-clean floor. There goes that dream, I thought to myself. Later, while working, checking Twitter, I decided to look at the dates anyway. Okay, most are in April. I technically could go then. You got your Brussels, your Oslo, your shitting me. They're playing Amsterdam on 420? My former stoner self was squealing on the inside. Going to Amsterdam on the unofficial holiday for smoking weed is ridiculous enough, but throwing a Dixie Chicks concert on top of it? This was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I had to go, and I knew the perfect travel crew for this adventure. Enter Jess and Tess, the Hot Mess Express. Now, y'all already met Jess in the previous chapter, but let me tell you about Tess. Tess is not only my PR guru, she's a Roman candle of a woman, blasting off fun wherever she's pointed. She can handle her scotch like she has the BMI of 1989 John Goodman. And she also does wacky, extravagant stuff, like getting a B. Arthur mosaic put at the bottom of her pool just because she knew looking at it would make her happy. Not 36 hours into each of them agreeing with a huge duh, Tess was already blowing up our group text about lodging. "Girls, I have found the perfect place. You're gonna die." I was nervous. Did she mean we were going to die because the place was so damn posh? Or were we going to die because she wanted to save some Skrilla and had booked us in a skeezy hostel from hostel situation? It's always a game of roulette when you're traveling with someone for the first time. I clicked the link and squinted my eyes, and sure enough, I died. My corpse finger mustered up the strength to click through the pics of a 100-year-old potato boat that had been renovated into a 2-bedroom houseboat in the 70s. That's right. A rusty on the outside, beautifully modern on the inside, century-old boat docked smack dab in the middle of one of the most beautiful canals in Amsterdam. We were going to have this glorious vessel for 3 whole nights, and it would still be cheaper than getting hotel rooms. Cut to 2 months later as we 3 ladies stood on the dock of our rusty abode. We were nervous it might be like a bad online date, where our boat looks like 80s Corey Haim in his profile, but present-day Corey Feldman in real life. We opened up the rusty hatch, walked down the stairs, and boom! It was glorious. Sighs of relief all around. Being jet-lagged as hell and dehydrated from our flight, we each drank a bunch of water and made ourselves stay up to adjust to the change in time. Ha ha! Lols! More like we each drank a bottle of red and passed out for 5 hours. We didn't mean to nap so long, but when you're in the belly of an old boat on a canal, it feels like you're strapped to a giant's bosom in a baby sling, being rocked back and forth. Once we woke up, we had to make up for lost time, a.k.a. head to the red light district. And, pardon me as I reach into my pocket and pull out another kohlrabi. For those of you who do not know what the red light district is, or are not familiar with TLC's Crazy Sexy Cool album, this is the neighborhood for sex stuff. Anything from innocent peep shows to full sex shows to legal prostitution can happen there. Before we went, we needed some liquid courage. We found an unassuming bar just outside the district that was full of dudes. Shocker. I don't even know what to expect, Jess said as she took down her third shot. Do people actually have sex on stage? Tess and I nodded, and Jess looked a little queasy. I don't think I can watch that. We're going, I said, motioning to the bartender for another round. It's part of the culture. You have to experience it. We made a pit stop at a cafe for a strawberry-flavored joint because nothing says tourists from America like 3 giggly girls surrounded by a cloud of smoke that smells like a scratch-and-sniff sticker. When we got to the red light district, I immediately found which sex show to go to. This one has a neon pink elephant wearing a tie. It's gotta be good, I squealed. My reasoning had no logic to it, but the girls agreed. I grabbed tickets from the box office and headed into Theater Casa Rosso, passing frame posters of various acts we were about to see. Of course, I couldn't read the signs because I don't speak Dutch, but if they didn't say coming attractions, I think we've all lost here. Now, what I'm about to describe is not for the faint of heart, and it almost made this heart faint. We walked in and immediately decided to distance ourselves from the stage by grabbing the front row balcony so that no one was blocking our view, but we were at least a good 50 yards from the splash zone. Okay, even I am aware of how gross that sounds. Could you imagine showing up to a sex show in a clear poncho, like we were going to see Shamu jumping out of the water or Gallagher sledgehammering some watermelons? To be fair, there was a lot of breaching and seed spreading on that stage. So I guess it's apropos. Heyo. We were the only people on the balcony besides a group of American girls who were in the very last row of the whole theater. I looked back at them as we carefully made our way down the stairs. Each one of them had their hands over their eyes or in front of their mouths. On stage, a man and a woman were having sex on a rotating circular bed as a generic techno song blared. At least, I assumed it was 2 humans. The sex resembled 2 cyborgs rubbing sprockets. Totally robotic. It was like they were going down a checklist of positions. After a few minutes of us giggling like wild women, we became entranced. The second the song was over, the duo popped up and walked off stage. Then the next couple came out. Same thing. This move. That move. This move. Song ends. Bye! It was like they clocked in for work, or should I say cocked in, hey-o. And then as soon as their shift ended, they said, peace, bitch, I'm off to happy hour. Next up, 2 girls came out and performed a double-sided dildo routine. It was like the last scene in Requiem for a Dream, but if the performers were actually on Ambien dreaming. We weren't the only ones who were clearly expecting a different show. This is so not what I thought it was going to be, Tiffany. I heard one of the girls a few rows behind us in a thick as Alfredo sauce Long Island accent. I didn't know, Renee, Tiffany clucked back, sounding like Janice from Friends. I can only assume that Tiffany was the poor maid of honor tasked with planning a bachelorette who had talked it up like they were about to thunder from down under. I couldn't blame them. Even I was beginning to regret the $50 entrance fee, too. So I turned to Jess and Tess and offered them an out.
Guys, what do you say we boogie out of here and go flirt with some real-life Dutch boys? Or even just go get drunk on our bomb-ass boat?
I could tell they had the same idea, but before they could admit it, the lights went dark and a bass-heavy techno song started pulsating through the speakers. We all leaned in, trying to understand the lyrics, which were spoken by the most Euro voice imaginable, like a rejected member from the 90s group The Real McCoy. After a few rounds of the repetitious voice, I finally caught on. I looked over at my girls to see if we were all doing the same thing, bobbing our heads to the driving beat while trying to mouth along with the muffled words. Then, all at once, we had it. We sang in unison, "Dark orgasm, dark orgasm, yes, dark orgasm, highly addictive." Those were the only lyrics. We were voguing in our seats, singing about this highly addictive dark orgasm, dying laughing. The Long Island girls were dying too, but only because I don't think any of them had breathed since they'd entered the theater. Meanwhile, we were in our own little world of singing and dancing, which was way more entertaining than anything that was happening on stage. That is, until we were snapped out of our dancing by a high-pitched, "Oh my God!" from behind us. We looked back to the stage and there she was. An Amazonian of a woman, clad in patent leather assless chaps, a belt of a bra with a leather crop in her hand. She force-strutted around the stage in a manner that can only be described as a Clydesdale in stripper heels meets Xena Warrior Princess cosplay costume. She continued clunking around to her orgasm jam, cracking that whip. I hadn't seen a performance so dead-eyed since I'd watched Britney perform in Vegas in 2013. It was an absolute train wreck, and we were living for it. When she finally finished, the three of us stood up and applauded, giving her the standing O we thought she deserved. I mean, someone needed to get an O on that stage in general, standing or otherwise. Before we could sit back down in our seats, we saw Xena was asking for volunteers to come on stage. "I'm going," Tess said, taking down the dregs of her double Johnny Walker red. We cheered as she trotted up the stairs, attempting to high-five the Long Island crew, who recoiled in disgust. "That's my bitch," I yelled as I watched her hightail it to the stage, foregoing the lift from the stagehand and hoisting herself up. Tess stood in line with the other victims, waiting to see what they were going to be made to do. Was she going to have to strip for tips while being whipped? Things were about to get bananas. And, oh, they did. Literally. Creeping up behind Tess was a man wearing, I kid you not, a gorilla suit. A gorilla suit. Let me remind you that Jess and I were two very high girls, watching our smiley friend being unknowingly approached by a man in a primate costume on stage at a sex show in Amsterdam. I just needed to remind you of the full scope of this scenario. So, Gorilla Man makes himself known, and Tess is cracking up, pretending she's going to grind on him, much to the delight of the Asian businessmen in the crowd. We watched Xena put the girls in line and explain to them what was going to happen. She wasn't mic'd, so we couldn't hear what she was saying, but I imagine it was just a series of grunts. Xena walked off stage and came back with a handful of bananas, giving one to the Gorilla Man, who is now lounging like a centerfold on the floor. "Go, Tess!" Jess and I yelled in unison, like we were cheering on our little pumpkin in an episode of Toddlers and Tiaras. Tess beamed from the stage, giving two thumbs up to the balcony. We shot her four thumbs up right back until we realized what was about to happen. The first volunteer was on her knees, taking bites of the banana as Gorilla Man positioned it like an erection on his crotch, her head bobbing up and down to get the bites. It was a lot more appalling than appealing. Tess locked eyes with us in the balcony and shook her head no. We shook our heads right back. Then, and this is why I love her, the bitch went rogue. While all the girls took their turns getting their daily dose of potassium while simulating BJs, Tess started dancing around the stage, twerking, dropping it low, and if my dance background serves me correctly, she even threw in a few Fosse moves. "Put that dark orgasm jam back on," she shouted as Xena tried to get her back in line. But Tess wasn't having it. She did a spin move away from Xena like she was a Harlem Globetrotter. Xena snapped and pointed for Tess to get in line, but Tess was not ready to make nice. Meanwhile, Jess and I were losing our minds, cheering for our girl and trying to get the rest of the crowd on our side. We were like sex show warm-up comics pointing to an applause sign before a commercial break. The song ended and, mercifully, the gorilla left the stage. Tess curtsied for her stage moms, soaking it all in. She was too busy hamming it up to notice that the gorilla had re-entered the stage, and this time with a new accessory. And that accessory was a giant strap-on. And this was no ordinary strap-on, which we can go ahead and add that sentence to things I never thought I'd say. No, no. That primate started working his equipment, and splash! It was also a massive water gun, and the gorilla was shooting the audience and volunteers on stage with fake jizz. Ugh! Tess burst out laughing and pointed towards the door. Jess and I started up those stairs so fast we fell down at the feet of the Long Islanders, who at this point were the living embodiment of the hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil chimps. Reunited, the three of us busted out the theater doors, wheezing with laughter as we ran down the cobblestone street. Did that really just happen? Or should I say strappin', I asked Tess, who was high on power, among other things. She ran into the nearest falafel shop, said, give us some free fries. And they did. No exchange of currency needed. They were either terrified or in awe of Tess, and I'm guessing both. We walked through the district like we owned it. Girls in light-up window displays catcalled us as we continued shoving fries in our face and recounting the night. Me, you just made a sex show your personal dance recital. Tess, I told the dominatrix that her dancing had no heart. She needs to put some passion into it. The red light district could be so much better with just a few changes. Leave it to Tess, PR extraordinaire, to focus on how the sex show needed to rebrand itself. When we hit our humble floating abode, we knocked out. The next day was spent recovering. Truth be told, we kind of blew our load on the first night, pun so goddamn intended. So we slept in to conserve our energy for the next night's show and spent the day sitting on the deck of the SS Tater Tot, drinking red wine, blaring Dixie Chicks to get us pumped up, and smoking the delicious strawberry-flavored joints we'd bought at the cafe. Once those munchies kicked in, we rolled up so high to a Thai restaurant that when I asked the waiter if the food was coming out so quickly because they wanted to get rid of us, he just said, absolutely. We went back to the boat and smoked another joint, reminiscing about the night before. Oh, my God, Jess said. Can you imagine if the Dixie Chicks asked us what we like most about Amsterdam and we were like, probably the ejaculating gorilla we saw at the sex show last night. We're disgusting people, I said, shaking my head and opening our millionth bottle of wine. I belly laughed so hard in the belly of the boat that night, it actually scared me, and I had to climb outside to get fresh air before passing out from exhaustion. I woke up the next morning, not knowing if I was nauseated from all the red wine, or laughing, or because I was straight up seasick, but no upset stomach was going to stop me that day. It was 4:20, Dixie Chickmas. We headed to the show, literally skipping to the stadium. While we had bought our own tickets, my agents had hooked us up with a meet and greet after the show. So not only were we going to hear those beautiful angels play, we were also going to get a hurried, awkward photo with them. If I could go back in time to show my teen self a pic with the Chicks, she would say, wow, I'm going to grow up to be awesome. Also, I'm going to start moisturizing daily, because those are wrinkles, girl. We were going in with lofty expectations for the show, and the Chicks far exceeded them. Not only did they sound tighter than a Pentecostal on her wedding night, but they were as ballsy as ever, even showing a pic of Chris Brown and Trump during Goodbye Earl. We sang, we cried, we yee-hawed too hard every time they mentioned 420, which, come to find out, 420 is solely an American thing. Based on all the reserved, seated Dutch audience shooting us judgy looks. After they wrapped up their second encore, the time had come. It was time to meet the Chicks. We headed backstage, ready to stand in line for our quick step-and-repeat pick. Turns out, however, this wasn't a cattle call situation. There were only 10 of us backstage, and they were going to take us back in small groups to meet and chat with the Chicks in a more intimate setting. Y'all are up! The sweet assistant motioned us over as she pushed open the heavy metal door. And there they were, Natalie, Marty, and Emily, a heavenly glow surrounding them. Natalie was finishing her conversation with a previous meet and greeter, Emily was making herself a drink, and Marty was trying to shove some much-deserved salad into her mouth. We stood in awe, but were snapped out of it by just how damn nice they were. They kept asking us questions about ourselves and couldn't believe that we'd traveled all the way to Amsterdam for their show. Are you kidding? I said, realizing how strong the drinks had been during the show. As soon as we found out y'all were touring, we knew we had to bring this sin wagon across the Atlantic.
Well, that deserves a cheers, and I, for one, need another drink, Natalie said, then turned to me. You're the drinks girl, right? Make me a drink.
Holy fuck. I was about to make a drink for Natalie Maines, a woman whose voice pumped through my shitty Honda Accord speakers for years, whose melodies echoed through the halls of my freshman dorm until some nerd would inevitably tell me to turn it down. I scanned the ingredients at the bar like I was on an episode of Chopped, and Ted Allen had just started the clock.
Girl, I just want some tequila with a bunch of lime juice in it, she said, clearly noticing the conflict in my head.
Oh, thank God, I didn't have to be creative. I squeezed those limes like my life depended on it, shook it with some silver tequila, and handed her the glass.
I call it a Maine's squeeze, I said, beaming from my ability to make a pun despite my starstruckness.
We cheers, and as I lifted the glass to my mouth, I wondered if Natalie would prefer to get matching BFF necklaces, or if we just go whole hog and spring for the matching tattoos.
Right as the Don Julio was about to touch my lips, I heard Jess snicker from across the room. She was clearly dishing out some good story based on her exaggerated arm movements, but I couldn't make out what she was saying through her laughs.
Then, clear as day, I heard Emily's voice say,
Wait a minute. It wasn't real jizz, was it? I froze as I watched the Hot Mess Express shake their heads like a couple of bobbleheads in the back window of a car. How the hell are we going to be besties with the Dixie Chicks if they knew how crazy we were? For the first time ever, I was jealous of Earl and his poison black-eyed peas. I scanned the room for open windows. I was ready to run. But before I could take that bottle of tequila and smash it over my head, Natalie grabbed my arm and pulled me over to the girls.
Hold on a second here. Start at the beginning. Y'all went to a sex club?
Cut to 1 hour later, and the Hot Mess Express and the chicks were piling into an SUV headed straight to the red light district.
I wish.
Instead, we chatted with them for a while longer, kept our cool, and then screamed our heads off on the dock of our boat as soon as we got out of our Uber. To celebrate, we went to the bar closest to our boat to play the jukebox. After all, some days, you just gotta dance. The next morning, we said bye to the boat and headed off to our separate flights. As I sat there on that tarmac, listening to the chicks in my headphones, I couldn't help but smile to myself. I pictured my teenage self in that bar back in North Carolina and how all the words I sang had come true. I had found wide open spaces and room to make big mistakes. I had seen new faces and I knew the high stakes. I just didn't realize how high they were going to be.
Pure cunt tree. If you are someone who gets offended by the word cunt, then I am sorry that you are so uptight, that is. Personally, I love the word. I don't know why people hate it so much. In fact, when I was little, I used to say, see you next Tuesday, as just a regular way to tell people goodbye, having no idea what it meant. I just thought it was a saying, but apparently 10-year-old me was inadvertently calling people cunts, complete with finger guns to really up the charm. I've heard the argument made that being called a pussy isn't an insult because pussies are unbelievably strong and resilient and can be thanked for all life on Earth. Well, the same thing applies to cunt. Take back the word, ladies. You gotta own it. I owned it on national TV less than a week before I wrote this chapter. I was filming an episode of my favorite and recently canceled show, At Midnight, playing against Howie Mandel when, through a series of joke callbacks, he called me a cunt. I wish I could go back in time and tell younger me that not only would Maurice from Little Monsters one day call her a cunt, she'd be so confident that she would take a breath, smile into the audience, and say, "You're damn right I am." Anyways, this is a roundabout way of saying some of my favorite cunts are in country music. A lot of people attribute the girl power movement to the Spice Girls hitting the scene back in the 90s, but country's been doing it for ages. And while I loved singing in a British accent and figuring out which Spice Girl I wanted to be among my friends when we choreographed dances, I related more to songs about Southern girls growing up and figuring out their life. But I'm sure some of you weren't lucky enough to grow up in the land of truck nuts and meth labs. Some of you grew up in classy places with classy parents who probably cranked NPR and Bach while you sat in the back seat. Well, pop in your other monocle and have your butler pull up your iTunes, because this here is a perfect starter pack for female empowerment with a drawl. May I recommend downloading all of them, then blaring them in your car as you drive through some back roads with your windows down? Or, you know, just pour a whiskey and dance around your house. Here's your See You Next Tuesday playlist.
Wild One by Faith Hill. This is such a great fuck you, parents, anthem. The song is about being told by your parents to stay in line and follow the rules with your classic don't listen to rock and roll and don't date the bad boy type directives. Every time she brushes them off like, hell no, I do what I want. But it really won my heart when they tell her to brush her hair and she says, some kids don't. Bitch is so rebellious that she won't brush her hair as a statement. As someone who has to lose rock, paper, scissors to herself to take a shower, I feel you, Faith. This one's for the girls by Martina McBride. Just like the Dixie Chicks' Goodbye Earl, where they kill an abusive husband with poison black-eyed peas, Martina also has a killer song about murdering her husband out of self-defense called Independence Day. But this one's for the girls is a sweet one, giving little pep talks to ladies through various phases of their lives. It's the type of song that's so universal, it makes you feel like it's written specifically for you. You think, wait a sec, I also have been 25 with a shitty apartment and living off SpaghettiOs. Yeah, nah, duh. Everyone's been there, but it still makes you feel like you're in this special lady club. Heads Carolina, Tails California by Joe D. Messina. Okay, fine. Maybe this one personally speaks to me because it's literally about the place I grew up and the place I live now, but it's a bop. There are so many songs that romanticize the South, but in this one, she's like, let's get the hell out of here. I love where I came from. It made me who I am. But do you see me hanging out at Dodge City every night, drinking Miller Lite and hoping I don't hit a deer on the way home? Nope. This country girl needed a city life, and so did Joe D. In addition to crooning some great tunes, she's a fiery redhead, and again, her name is Joe D. If that doesn't sound like a woman you want to roll into a dive bar and pool shark some dudes with, I don't know who is. She's in Love with the Boy by Trisha Yearwood. This is the only one on the list that's about love, but I had to include it. It's your stereotypical song about a father not approving of his daughter's choice of boyfriend, so it's not reinventing the wheel. However, I love this one because the dad's basically saying that his daughter's beau is an idiot. And then the mom busts in to say, my dad hated you when we met too. Get over it. In real life, Trisha is married to dream man Garth Brooks, has a cooking show on the Food Network, and actually looks like a real woman. She doesn't try to be a rail and then go on TV and pretend to eat all the comfort food she cooks. Not that anyone would do that, Giada. Born to Fly by Sarah Evans. This is one of the more saccharine of the bunch. Your classic anthem with the theme of how do you keep your feet on the ground when you know you were born to fly? Typical, right? But it gets extra points because the first few lyrics are comprised of her literally talking to a scarecrow. Sarah, we've all been lonely, and I understand that mental health help is expensive, but confiding in a man who's just your dad's old flannel shirt filled with straw is no substitute for therapy. Guys Do It All the Time by Mindy McCready. This is one of those songs that make you want to stand up and scream, preach it, girl, like you're a damn Wendy Williams audience member. It's basically a song about how hypocritical dudes are when women party. She comes home and her dude is mad and she's like, oh, hell no. As a woman who can outdrink men four times my size, I appreciate her standing up for the booze hounds. Any Man of Mine by Shania Twain. I think we can all admit that our favorite Canadian country crooner took it a little too far, and that don't impress me much. Honey, if you truly aren't impressed by a rocket scientist or guy who looks like Brad Pitt, well, then your expectations might just be too damn high. But she gets off her high horse and makes her request a little more relatable in this cowboy stomper. All she's asking for is her man to lie when her dress is too tight, disagree when she's having a bad hair day, and say her burnt-ass cooking is delicious. Some people think in a relationship that honesty is the best policy, but I honestly think the best policy is a little lie can keep it fly. I've never said that in my life, but consider it trademarked. And now, a couple of old-school country classics to pop into your dive bar's jukebox for immediate street cred. Harper Valley PTA by Jeannie C. Riley. This song came out in 68, and I'm pretty sure it's the first song ever written about slut-shaming. The subject of the song is given a note from her daughter's PTA saying she wears her skirts too short. Homegirl walks in there with her miniskirt and drops the mic, saying things like, you're a drunk, you got your secretary pregnant, you keep asking me out, and I say no. By the time she walks out of the meeting, she has spilled all the PTA. Don't come for Jeannie's wardrobe unless you ain't got any dirty laundry yourself. The Pill by Loretta Lynn. Y'all, Loretta Lynn is just the badass of badasses. I mean, besides the old stuff, she made one of my favorite records of all time with Jack White,
from the White Stripes when she was 72. But back in 75, she was pissing off conservatives, aka my favorite pastime on Twitter. This song's basic message is that it's not fair that her husband gets to go out and have all this fun while she's at home popping.